Hubble Space Telescope has been orbiting Earth for 19 years, and it's working better than ever. That's what NASA officials said today. They were releasing the first images taken by Hubble after astronauts refurbished it. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has the story.
The Hubble Space Telescope has been upgraded 5 times in space. The most recent mission almost didn't happen. It was canceled after the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster. NASA officials felt going to Hubble again might be too risky. But astronomers fought the decision, hoping to keep Hubble alive. And in the end, the mission went forward in May. Astronauts did 5 tricky spacewalks. They installed a new camera, added a fancy new spectrograph, plus fixed 2 other instruments. Ed Weiler heads up NASA's Science Mission Directorate. He says after the mission was over, he kept hearing one question.
When are we going to see the pictures? We know we've had successful spacewalks, but when will we see the pictures?
Today, at a press conference at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., a music video featuring colorful new pictures flashed on a screen. Faraway galaxies, a nebula shaped like a butterfly, and a densely packed star cluster. After a summer testing and calibrating the telescope, scientists say Hubble is now more powerful than ever before. Heidi Hamel works at the Space Science Institute in Boulder, Colorado.
We in the community are already starting to get our data, and we're giddy with the quality of the data that we have with this new telescope.
David LaCrone is senior project scientist for Hubble at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. He says with the new and improved Hubble, the backgrounds of images are full of interesting detail.
You can already see remarkable differences between what we're seeing now and what we saw with the prior instrumentation, just in this ability to see, look what's in the background. My goodness, I didn't realize that was there.
He says plans for future observations include studying objects like Pluto at the edge of our solar system and analyzing the atmospheres of planets around other stars. The astronauts who did all these fixes last spring say they were amazed by the new pictures. Mike Massimino says when they closed up Hubble for the last time and came home, they thought the mission had gone well.
And so it's really great to see the evidence that it actually does work, and those images just look great. And I am so grateful that it's working and that I didn't break anything.
NASA has no plans to repair Hubble again. The hope is that it will continue working until at least 2014. That's when the agency plans to launch the James Webb Space Telescope, a new large space observatory. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
And you can see that nebula shaped like a butterfly and more Hubble images at npr.org.
If you were to pick up a pound of coffee at the store, you could reasonably expect it to weigh as much as it did last week or last year or 10 years ago. So you may be surprised to hear that it might not be the case. That's because the pound is defined against the metric system's unit of weight, the kilogram. And the kilogram may be changing. Jeff Brumfield reports.
This story starts with a metal cylinder about the size of a salt shaker. It was forged over 100 years ago in London. From there, it traveled to a suburb of Paris, where it was weighed, polished, and locked in a vault. And it's stayed there ever since. This little cylinder is the kilogram. I'll say it again, the kilogram. This is the one on which all other kilograms are based. That makes it very valuable.
I mean, I picked up its container, and I've looked at it, but I have not had the pleasure of actually handling it.
Richard Davis works at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures, where the kilogram is kept. He's been in charge of the cylinder since 1993, but they won't actually let him weigh anything with it. And there's a good reason for that.
It can be affected by many things. It can get dirty. It needs to be cleaned. You need to watch out about scratching.
The scientists who keep watch are so paranoid that they've only taken it out 3 times, in 1889, 1946, and 1989. Each time, they used it to check a set of copies. In the beginning, the copies in the kilogram weighed the same. Today, that's no longer the case. Peter Morris with the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, in Gaithersburg, Maryland. He studied the measurements.
They don't have a lot of data, but it shows that they're drifting apart.
In other words, the weight of the official kilogram seems to be changing. No one really knows why. The cylinder might be absorbing air and getting heavier, or washing it before each use may have made it lighter. Or it could be that the copies are changing. There's just no way to tell.
It is the kilogram. There's nothing to compare it to. It is the standard. And so if it's changing, there's no way to know it.
The bottom line is that nobody is sure whether that cylinder in Paris, the official kilogram, weighs the same as it did 100 years ago. The entire metric system hangs in the balance. Well, sort of. The change is small, at most 50 micrograms. That's billionths of a kilogram.
The actual ramifications for a person going to the store and buying something will be negligible. But for very precise work, it makes a difference. And for scientific work, it makes a difference.
And because of this, scientists want to throw out the metal cylinder altogether and replace it with a reliable number that won't change. To get this number, they've got to weigh the kilogram in a completely different way. They've got to measure its mass without using another weight as a reference. And they've got to do it really carefully. So NIST has built a special scale. It's kept out back near the woods in a small building whose entryway is covered in little shreds of something black.
I have to apologize about the rubber on the floor. We have a raccoon that gets up into the rafters there, and he pushes the stuff out the little cracks.
Rich Steiner is in charge of the scale, which is called a watt balance.
You mentioned about being far out. Yes, we're very far out. That we have probably more raccoons come out here than visitors.
Inside of a raccoon-free room is a two-story contraption. Instead of using weights, it uses electrical and magnetic forces to measure the mass of a metal cylinder, an official copy of the kilogram in Paris.
The fundamental part of this is actually fairly simple. It's basically a very highly calibrated bathroom scale.
Now here's how this thing is going to replace the cylinder with a fixed number. Once Rich Steiner can weigh the kilogram accurately enough, he'll be able to relate it to one of the so-called constants of nature, numbers that never change, like the speed of light. This will turn the kilogram into a number as permanent as the constants themselves. The challenge is that the cylinder must be weighed with atomic precision, and that's where the watt balance comes in. It's sensitive to as little as 10 billionths of a kilogram.
If you pulled a hair out of a person's head and then weighed them, we could tell the difference.
Unfortunately, a scale that sensitive is sensitive to a lot of other things, too. Vibrations from passing lawnmowers, for example, the tides, even earthquakes on the other side of the planet upset it, which is why it's taking so long to weigh the kilogram. Steiner's been at it for 16 years, and he considers himself a newcomer to the field.
It's just complicated, because we're making mechanical measurements, and we're doing it at a precision of 8 digits.
Despite all the problems, Steiner is confident that scientists will be able to redefine the kilogram in 5 or 6 more years. When that happens, the little cylinder in Paris will be replaced by a single number 8 digits long. Anybody with a watt balance and a lot of patience will be able to check it for themselves. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Here's one way to cut carbon emissions. Bury the stuff in farm fields. The Senate is considering a plan that would pay farmers to do just that as part of a climate and energy bill. The bill would essentially raise the cost of any fuel that emits carbon dioxide, the main contributor to climate change. As a result, farmers would see higher prices for their fuel and fertilizer. The payments for burying the carbon on their land would soften the blow, as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The American Clean Energy and Security Act aims to make companies reduce the amount of carbon dioxide they emit or be penalized. Reducing emissions can be hard and expensive, so the bill creates something called an offset. It's kind of like a get-out-of-jail card in Monopoly. A company could offset its emissions by paying someone else to get rid of carbon instead, someone who can do it more cheaply. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack recently told Congress that farmers would be delighted to get paid to store some of that carbon.
They'll be able, through the use of land, through cover crops, through altering how they use fertilizer, to how they raise livestock, to what they do with their land. I mean, there are a series of steps that can be taken and will be taken that will generate opportunities for offsets.
A good place to store carbon is in dirt, something farmers have a lot of. Dirt is full of organic matter, plant residue, microorganisms, earthworms. It's chock full of carbon. And theoretically, if you don't till the field, more of the carbon stays put. Guided by that belief, members of Congress want to allow farmers to sell offsets earned by no-till farming. Does it work? Scientists say maybe.
My name is Michelle Cavagelli. I'm a soil scientist with the USDA in Beltsville, Maryland.
Cavagelli shows me a no-till plot.
We have a corn crop on our left, and we have a soybean crop on our right. We might want to go inside the field a little bit. Okay, so I'm digging up the soil. You'll notice that when I break it apart, it breaks apart relatively easily. It's not a hard block like a brick.
Compared to a plowed field, this one has lots of dead vegetation in and on top of the dirt.
The percentage of organic matter in this soil, for example, is 2%. Twice as much as in some of the tilled systems at the very surface.
At the surface and down to about 4 inches or so. And the carbon will stay put if it isn't plowed. Plowing exposes the soil's organic matter to the air. It breaks down and the carbon goes up into the atmosphere.
If you till it, you can lose almost all the carbon you gained in the previous 5 years, say, with one tillage even. So one of the challenges is to maintain your no-till fields forever, in essence, to really gain the benefits of carbon sequestration.
But that doesn't fit in with the kind of no-till that most American farmers practice.
The reason is farmers plow 1 year and they do the no-till next year.
That's Ratan Lal, a soil scientist at Ohio State University. Moreover, Lal says research finds that no-till fields actually don't store any more carbon than plowed fields if you look deeper, say 3 feet down. So, do no-till fields really qualify as carbon offsets? Lal says they can store more carbon than a plowed field if the conditions are just right, the right kind of soil and soil temperature, for example. There's a possible conflict brewing here, though. Federal law and the energy bill encourage farmers to remove crop residue to make ethanol. And, says Lal,
that's a no-no. The moment you take the crop residue away, the benefits on no-till farming, on erosion control, water conservation, on carbon sequestration will not be realized.
Nonetheless, Lal supports no-till for carbon offsets, mostly because of how no-till fields are planted. When you don't plow, you use less fossil fuel to run equipment and make fertilizer.
Saving in diesel, saving in labor, saving in fertilizer consumption, saving in time.
These savings mean that no-till has a smaller carbon footprint than plowing. Farm interests are eager to win offsets for farmers, in part because they say the energy bill will raise their fuel costs across the board. The final list of what will be allowed in the bill could help win supporters when the Senate votes on the measure. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
We've been following NASA's plan to return astronauts to the moon by the year 2020, but that is not going to happen without a lot more money. Billions and billions more. That's the conclusion of an expert panel convened by the White House to consider the future of human spaceflight. The panel says there are other ways that people could explore space without landing on the moon. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has more.
NASA has been flying the space shuttles for decades, but the agency is currently planning to retire its aging fleet after a half dozen more missions. Under a plan developed by the previous administration, astronauts would then ride Russian rockets to the space station for a few years, while NASA focused on building rockets that could go to the moon and beyond.
The goals of the program are very lofty, you know, to explore the moon and go on to Mars.
Edward Crawley is a professor of engineering at MIT. He says trouble is NASA's resources don't match these goals.
In simple words, there isn't enough money in the budget to do the program which has been laid out.
Crawley serves on a blue ribbon panel of outside experts put together by the White House. It's been studying NASA's current program as well as other possible ways forward and has just released a summary of its findings. The report says the space shuttle may need funding for an extra year to complete its remaining missions. And it also says there's good arguments for extending the life of the International Space Station. Currently, there's no money budgeted for the station past 2015. But as Crawley points out, we've spent over two decades working on it.
And it really only became a functioning laboratory within the last year. So the idea that after only about 5 years, this national laboratory would be retired really didn't make sense to us.
The space station is close to Earth, just a couple hundred miles up. And the panel says the government should consider whether private companies could take over much of the space traffic to low Earth orbit.
It's an appropriate time to say, you know, is this something that could essentially be privatized, that the commercial community could do as a commercially provide service more cost effectively than the government?
This would allow NASA to focus on more long distance space travel, which it could do if it had more money. The panel says NASA's budget needs a boost of about $3 billion a year to do meaningful human exploration. Using the rockets that NASA is currently developing, or different designs, NASA could either return astronauts to the surface of our moon or pursue what the panel calls a flexible path of exploration. Crawley explains that astronauts wouldn't land anywhere, but would venture out farther and farther from Earth, flying by things like asteroids.
And even as far as going in a flyby of Mars and into Mars orbit and rendezvousing with Phobos and Deimos, the moons of Mars.
If you read this report, I think it becomes rather clear that they have a preferred option.
John Logsdon is a space policy expert at George Washington University. He wasn't on the panel, but he thinks its members seem to prefer this flexible path over a moon landing. Still, he says, it's ultimately not up to them. They just offered up options.
There's a menu that's been laid out, but it's really up to President Obama to make a choice among the options that he asked for.
A White House spokesman said in a written statement that until the options have been thoroughly considered, it would be premature for anyone to draw conclusions from the committee's work. He said the president would consult with senior advisors, including the administrator of NASA, before making any final decisions. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Archaeologists digging in a cave in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia have come across the world's oldest textiles. They found flax fibers that date back 30,000 years or more. The find suggests that string isn't as humble as it seems. It could have helped our ancestors survive the last ice age, as NPR's Richard Harris reports.
30,000 years ago, humans in Europe were trying to shrug off the cold of the last ice age. Some people lived in caves in the present-day Republic of Georgia. To get a picture of life back then, scientists look at pollen from those caves to figure out what plants were around when the people were. Ofer Bar-Yosef from Harvard explains that a colleague of his put some cave pollen into a chamber to look at it under the microscope.
Her major discovery was that many of these pollen samples actually contain fibers of flax.
Flax was growing wild at the time, and it turns out not only to be a source of edible grain, but of fiber. These fibers were twisted, a sure sign that the flax had been spun. Now, flax fibers woven together make linen, but in this case, linen doesn't mean crisply pressed summer suits. Bar-Yosef says the fibers they found in the cave were probably braided together macrame style.
You can make headgear, you can make baskets, you can make ropes, and strings, and so on.
He didn't find any of those objects in the cave. That's too much to hope for 30,000 years later. But the researchers report in Science magazine that they did find evidence the fibers were knotted and dyed, black, gray, turquoise, and pink. That's consistent with other artifacts that show an artistic flair among these early people. The news of this ancient textile is exciting indeed to Elizabeth Barber, a retired professor from Occidental College who literally wrote the book on prehistoric textiles.
I mean, talk about the proverbial needle in the haystack. Trying to find fibers that are 30,000 years old really is almost impossible.
Barber says evidence of textiles dates back 25,000 years already. There are impressions of woven material found in clay. It's clear now that the technology is even older, and that fits nicely with her hypothesis that plain old string was a powerful technology which helped people weather the last ice age.
It totally revolutionized what they could do. I mean, on a very simple basis, think about the fact that you can tie things up into packages so you can carry more. You can put out nets and snares to catch more game so you can eat better, and so on and so forth.
We, of course, think of clothing when we think of woven materials, but Barber says woven clothing was probably not around 30,000 years ago.
There's no real evidence that they wore clothing. I mean, if you were cold, you would pull you know, the pelt from that came off of last night's dinner around your shoulders.
Instead, she says woven clothing developed not so much for comfort as for fashion, socially important fashion.
It's not until you start to get haves and have-nots that people start differentiating themselves by, look what I'm wearing, as opposed to what you're wearing or not wearing.
So how then does she explain the pink and turquoise dyes on those ancient fibers? Simple, she says.
We love color. Our brains go zing when they see color.
So colored string? Why not? Richard Harris, NPR News.